kind of thing. The we'll read the 17th chapter of Revelation to the 21st verses. Now this plague produces another plague. You notice that? See, this plague is poured out upon the air. But as a result, they get a plague of hail that comes from heaven. And every stone about the weight of a town. But that's just a sidelight. This plague is not poured out. The emphasis is not through the air. I mean, sometimes we try to give it a simple application, but that isn't the thought. This is upon the air. It's directed towards the spiritual ruling powers of earth. It exposes that element. Now, on this, we feel it's just our thought that this seventh angel would be the final understanding of Revelation that could be used in this work. It would be a plague. And from this, of course, we would have to borrow extensively from Brother Russell's writings in various places and add additionally what has transpired from 6 days from now to finish up the picture. Brother Russell did look for and hoped in his lifetime to give a completed work. It was not given in his day, although we feel that all the basic material necessary was given for the final understanding of the book. But we feel that this might be the last message that would be a final harmonization of all the truths, particularly these judgment truths that we have here in Revelation. Now, of course, there may be variations of viewpoint on this, but that's just an opinion. You may not like the opinion, or you may. It doesn't matter. If you have a better suggestion, that's all right, but that's an opinion. Now, this is the final work. Remember, in the seventh phase, the wrath of God was to be filled up. And so we come to the seventh one, and that's the finale. That's the end. And when this happens, what happens to Babylon? This final plague is poured out. The great city is... What happens?
Divided into three parts.
Hey, where's your coalition? Now, you notice up to this point, there's been the dragon, the beast, the false prophet. Don't they all make up Babylon, in a sense? Aren't they the coalition that have made up Babylon? There they were together. That's shown in the 19th chapter, too. They were all fighting on the same side. But when this plague is poured out, we see the city is divided. Every part for himself. The beast for himself, the dragon for himself, and the false prophet for himself. That's the end of your unholy alliance. And you know the expression, divide and conquer. That's what happens here. The division is complete. Babylon is divided, and it's in a state of collapse. That's the end, really, of all the trouble. We see that they're still after this. When this happens, this means that everything happens then. This marks the final end of the social order and everything associated with it. This is Armageddon. This is the time when he says every island fled away. There's your smaller government collapsing. The mountains weren't found. The kingdoms collapsed. There we see the great period of anarchy that we look for as the final aspect of the trouble. There we see the hail falling upon men, these great truths that come out of heaven. And they blaspheme God because of the plague of the hail. But we see all of these factors take place. But here again, we have an interesting parallel. We begin to show that these things, I think, and we can prove scripturally that these things just can't apply any which time. Let's turn to the 37th chapter of Ezekiel. Remember, the 38th chapter, I'm sorry, I have been giving you the wrong chapter. The 38th chapter, remember, without me even going into any detail, this is the chapter that deals with Gog and Magog, and how Israel dwells in a peaceful land among walled villages and so on. And we're not really considering this chapter, so we're not making a study of it, but we're just trying to get you acquainted with the facts of this chapter, to tie it in with Revelation, the 16th chapter. Again, another parallel. Then it says, and thou shalt, reading in the fifth verse, and thou shalt come from thy place from the north parts, and thou many people with thee, and of all them riding upon horses, a great company, and a mighty army. And thou shalt come up against my people Israel as a cloud to cover the land, as it shall bring in the latter, it shall be in the latter days. And I will bring thee against my land, that the heathen may know me, when I shall be sanctified in thee, O God, before their eyes. Thus saith the Lord, art thou he of whom I have spoken in old times by my servants, the prophets of Israel, which prophesied in those days many years that I would bring thee against them? It shall come to pass at that same time when Gog shall come against the land of Israel, saith the Lord, that my fury shall come up in my face. Here is the time of the Lord's judgment. Notice the parallel here between that of the sixth of the last plague. This was the time that filled up the wrath of God, the time of the final judgment. The Lord says it is done. And Babylon comes up in remembrance before God to drink of the fury of his wrath. Parallel. This is the time when God comes against Israel. This is a time when God's fury is at its height. He says, for in my jealousy and in the fire of my wrath have I spoken, surely in that day there shall be a great shaking in the land of Israel, so that to the fishes of the sea and the fowls of the air. Notice he speaks about it as being in Israel, but it affects the whole earth. He says, so that the fishes of the sea and the fowls of the heaven and the beasts of the field and all creeping things which creep upon the earth and all men that are upon the face of the earth shall shake at my presence. And notice the parallel. The mountains shall be thrown down. The steep places shall fall, and every wall shall fall to the ground. And I will call for a sword against him throughout all my mountains, saith the Lord. Every man's sword shall be against his brother. And I will plead against him with pestilence and with blood, and will rain upon him and my band, and upon his band, upon the people that are with him, with an overflowing rain, with great hailstones, fire and brimstone. Thus will I magnify myself, and I will sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations, and they shall know that I am the Lord. Now, can you conceive of two such great separate earthquakes, so that the mountains fall and the islands flee away and the great hail falls down from heaven? Or we may quibble as to whether the destruction of Armageddon starts when Gog invades Israel, or whether it'll be the last feature. But we can argue the fact that they happen. We can't argue the fact that they happen in the same general time. Whether it precedes or follows, but we see that Gog's invasion is at the same time of Babylon's destruction. It's in this same period that God's full wrath comes on. It's at this time that there's an earthquake so mighty and so great that the cities of the nations fell and the mountains fall. You see, this is the time of the end. This is the time when the Lord calls for a sword against him and all his holy mountains. And it's reasonable to conclude that this is the final end. This marks the end of papacy. This marks the end of God's invasion. Actually, I've been prone to the belief that that would be the last and final act of the papacy. That is, instigation of God's invasion. That's the work of the devil. And the papacy has been the devil's mouthpiece. And we see that Brother Russell always said that we know Satan was bound and papacy was destroyed. And that is where the seat of the beast is, where, remember, where Satan sits.
And we're glad.
Very happy. There are many faces here that were not here at our previous study. And so our first portion will be review, more or less, so that the friends here can get a kind of a sense of what has been taking place in this meeting. Now, we are basically concerned in this study with five beasts. There are five beasts in Revelation, and three of them have a particular, one common characteristic. And who can name these three beasts and name the one characteristic that they have in common? What was the first beast that we considered? Revelation 12.
The dragon.
Yes, and this dragon had what to describe it?
It had seven heads and ten horns.
Yes.
Seven crowns.
That's right. The seven heads. It had seven heads and seven and ten horns. All the seven crowns that it had were something that was dissimilar from the other beasts. Now, we have a picture of this, and keep this matter in our mind, help clarify it to us, we'll illustrate. This is apparently a replica of the best we are able to draw of the vision that John saw in the 12th chapter of Revelation, which is a picture of a dragon. This dragon, we are told, had seven heads, had ten horns, and it had the phenomenal thing about this beast, it had seven crowns, one on each head. And of course, there's considerable detail concerning this beast in the 12th chapter of Revelation, which we will not, of course, be able to do tonight, but we concluded that this beast represented the civil power of Rome that went through seven successive stages of government. It represents the civil power of Rome, and the crowns on its head show that these heads, the ruling powers over the Roman Empire, were considered the proper sources of authority in the Roman Empire. This beast, the first picture that we have of it, we found it in heaven. Later we found that this beast was cast out of heaven, and it was on the earth, showing that the civil power of Rome lost, after a period of time, its authority in spiritual matters. One of the beasts that we consider. That's the dragon. Now, that's a separate beast from the other animals. Then we considered another beast that had seven heads, but it was different in some respects, in many respects. But the only way that it was similar was in from the standpoint that it had seven heads. That's the only relationship between this beast and the other beast of Revelation. It had seven heads, but you'll notice there are ten crowns, not seven crowns like in the other picture. There are ten crowns upon this leopard-like beast. And from our previous study, we learned that this leopard-like beast was a peculiar animal, not only that it had seven heads, but it had the mouth of a lion, it had the feet of a bear, and it had the body of a leopard. Now, these three beasts are identified in the in Daniel. In Daniel's account, he tells of the four universal empires. And one of them was a bear, one of them was a lion, and one of them was a leopard. The lion was the Medo, or the Babylonian Empire, as I recall it, and the bear was Medo-Persia, and the leopard was Grecia, And the fourth beast, which was so exceeding dreadful that he couldn't describe it, seems to be a description somewhat of this beast, which is so dreadful that it's difficult to describe. But the four universal empires, all the craftiness, all the cunning, all the deceit and wickedness of those four universal empires are concentrated in this beast. This beast, we understand, represents the papacy. It had seven heads and ten horns. In other words, this fits into the same setting as the dragon that we saw. The seven heads represent what? What does a head show? That's right. In other words, if you wanted to portray time in prophecy, you couldn't do it in much other way in drawing a picture than by showing that there were seven heads. Each head ruled for a time. They didn't all rule at the same time, but each head ruled for a time. The first head, and then the second head, and so on. That apparently is what is portrayed here by the seven heads. All right. This had, you remember, ten crowns rather than the seven that were on the heads on the dragon, but in this instance they are on the horn, showing that the papacy recognized the kings over the territorial divisions of Rome. That is, the kings that they crowned and uncrowned were the ones that they recognized. There was a controversy between the papacy and civil Rome. Originally, the dragon was in heaven, but we found that as the man-child, this Antichrist, this man of sin, ascended in power, it was caught up to God and to his throne, and we find that this papal hierarchy, this element that ruled the papacy, gained control of the spiritual heavens, and the dragon was cast out, and his powers were limited to the earth. And then we observed another phenomena in the 13th chapter of Revelation, that this dragon was more of a gentleman, shall we say, than this leopard-like beast, because the dragon gave its seat and great power and authority to this leopard-like beast. It more or less allowed the papacy to exercise authority in the civil affairs of earth. That's the picture. All of these beasts that we consider, the five beasts in Revelation, we found actually that the most of them, or all of them, wind up here as pictures here upon the earth. And the picture of the leopard-like beast portrays the papacy in the civil affairs of earth. Whereas the man-child, the Antichrist, portrays the papacy more or less in the spiritual realm. Well, there were some other beasts. There was a two-horned beast that we learned about. And what does that two-horned beast represent?
Church of England and Ireland.
Yes. This is also portrayed in our last study. We discussed this in considerable detail. I don't think we're doing it justice in the case of review. But we understand that this beast represents the Church of England and Ireland as powers in the earth. That is shown in the 13th chapter of Revelation. And also, we found that this two-horned beast suggested a certain thing. And what did it suggest to the people of the nations around about it? It suggested that they make what? An image to the beast. And not only did it have power to suggest this, but after this beast, this image of the beast was formed, we were told in Revelation, the 13th chapter, that this beast had power. It had power to do four things. What was that? Does anyone remember the four things that this beast had power to do? recorded there in the 13th chapter of Revelation, near the end of the chapter. It has power to
give life to the image of the being.
That's right. Well, then it should do what? What kind of life is it that it's going to get? So that it could speak.
Amen.
Right? So that it could speak and cause as many as would not worship this beast to be killed. So it had speaking power. It had the power of authority to speak. It had power to ostracize or kill or not recognize as a Christian. That, of course, is symbolic. We know that the killing there is symbolic, just like the beast is symbolic. It has the power of ostracizing. What else? Yes, it had prohibiting power, so that as many as would not worship this beast couldn't buy or sell, and it had power to also designate a fortune. It caused all, both great and small, to receive a mark in their forehead or in their right hand. So it had those four powers. This two-horned beast had power to give life to this image, to cause it to do four things. Speak, designate, ostracize, and finally prohibit. Well, now we've briefly covered four beasts. We don't have a picture of the image of the beast, but tonight we're interested in the 17th chapter of Revelation, which is perhaps the most. Can I take this plastic off here?
Yeah, that is just a paper thing.
We'll get a better look at this picture. But in the meantime, if someone will find the 17th chapter of Revelation, we'll read a few chapters or a few verses. See, in our review, we really tried to squeeze into about 5 or 10 minutes what it took us 4 hours to cover before, so it's too hasty if you haven't gone over this matter. Well, we won't show a close-up yet anyway. We're going to read a little bit, and then we'll hold it up for analysis to help the mind's eye to absorb this picture. And before we read this, I want to just observe one thing. This chapter, the 17th chapter of Revelation, is one of the few chapters that is complete in itself. Now, in our other studies, all we were is introduced, for instance, to the dragon. We were introduced to the dragon, and we were told how it was cast out of heaven and how it made war with the woman. And when we last heard of the dragon, it was angry, and it was going to make war with the remnant of her seed, but it didn't tell us the results of that. That all comes up later in Revelation. And when we were introduced to this leopard-like beast, we were told about its seven heads and how one of the heads were wounded. And the query was asked when this leopard-like beast was on the scene. It was asked in Revelation, well, who was able to make war with this beast? And we didn't get the answer to that. The answer comes up later. The answer comes up very prominently later. There's no question as to who is able to make war with this beast and to slay it. As a matter of fact, in the 13th chapter, some of the saints didn't do a bad job of making war with this beast. They wounded one of the heads, so that it almost died, and everyone marveled that the beast had healed, which was a wound that the papacy received in the Reformation. But it wasn't able to kill this beast, because this beast had a designated time in which it could extend its power for 1260 years. We finished also the study of the image of the beast. And we didn't hear the end of the story. It just introduced it to us. It said that the two-horned beast had power to give life to the image, so that the image should speak and designate and mark and so on. But it didn't tell us the final story This all unfolds in chapters 14, 15, 16, 18, and 19. The rest of the story is filled in. We learn how this dragon goes to make war with the remnant of her seed, and we learn how the King of Kings finally is able to make war against this beast, and we learn what happens to the image and to the two-horned beast. All of that comes up later. But here in this 17th chapter, you have a complete story. And within the content of this one chapter, it tells you from start to finish what it starts out to talk about. Now, that's one difference. All right, now we're going to read the first three verses. Who will volunteer to do that, please? Bob, do you have it there? Please.
And there came out one of the seven angels, which had the seven vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns.
All right, now, here we are introduced to this beast. But remember, the reason why this beast was introduced by the Revelator was for what purpose? What is he trying to tell us in this 17th chapter of Revelation? He tells us of who?
Of the great whore.
That's right. And who is this great whore? Yes, it's this unfaithful church, the Antichrist church, which is the papacy. Although we call the papacy more or less the leopard-like beast from the standpoint of its influence in earthly affairs. But in spiritual matters, we think of it as the man of sin, or also as an unfaithful church, which is portrayed by an adulterous woman. Now, that's what this chapter is concerned about. And he says, we're going to tell you the judgment of this great whore, and he does it. But before he tells you how the whore is destroyed and all of that, he goes into a long roundabout introduction. He starts the setting of a story. In other words, sometimes you start to tell somebody something and you say, well, before I get to the point, I want to tell you the whole story so that you'll understand the matter when I get to the point that I'm trying to make. So that this matter will be clear in your mind, because if I just tell you the facts of the judgment of this woman and so on, you won't understand how and when and all this is going to take place. But I want to tell you the whole background of this story and how finally this is all going to lead up to the destruction of this woman. And that's what the 17th chapter is really doing. The Revelator is here saying that I'm going to tell you, show you, the judgment of this great whore. Now, this beast, we are told, has how many heads?
Seven
heads. That's, again, the only similarity it has to the other two beasts. There are three beasts that have seven heads. Now, what are they again? What's the first one? The dragon. Leopard-like beast. And finally, this scarlet-colored beast. Now, you'll notice how many crowns are on this beast? Ten? Are you sure? There are no crowns on this beast. Now, that's a distinction, is it not? We want to learn its similarities and its distinctions. And we find that while the dragon had seven crowns, the leopard beast had three more crowns. He had ten, and they were on the horns. And this poor beast has no crown at all. So you see, it's a poor beast without any crown. And no voice in government at the time that this picture was taken. And that's what we're told, actually, in the account when the Revelator begins to tell us the mystery of this picture, which we'll get to. He'll explain all this for us. But now, we'll read a little bit more. We'll take the verses 4 through 6.
Virginia, do you have it there, please?
Yes. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet colors, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand, full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth.
Well, read the next verse that ties in there.
And I saw the woman broken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration.
Yes. Well, now, is there any question at all as to who this woman is that's writing to you? Has anyone got any doubt in their mind as to who this woman could possibly be? Who is the woman that's drunk with the blood of the martyrs and the saints, that wore out the saints of the Most High God, that persecuted them, that slaughtered more Christians in her day than the pagan Roman Empire did in its fury against Christianity? Who is it? Yes, well, we'll call it the Roman Catholic Church. There's no question about it. We're not just talking about her as a government and civil powers, but we're talking about a church, a woman. The Roman Catholic Church is only the one woman that has been so perverse and so wicked, and that it has had such a long life. This woman has had a very, very long life, which we'll get into in our description. But we don't understand what this beast is because no one has told us what it represents so far. So now the Revelator, he saw the picture, and everyone's marveling at this woman that's riding on a beast with seven heads, with a scarlet-colored beast, and they're wondering what this all means. Well, they've maybe figured out what the woman represented, but they don't know what this beast represents. It certainly isn't like the other two beasts. It's a different beast altogether. The only thing that's similar about it has seven heads. All right, now the angel, he comes to the rescue. He's going to tell us now what this means. So we'll read a little bit more. Verses 7 and 8. Who'll take that, please?
And the angel said unto me, Wherefore didst thou marvel? I will tell thee the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which hath the seven heads and ten horns. The beast that thou sawest was and is not, and shall ascend out of the bottom of the pit and go into perdition. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they behold the beast that was and is not, and yet is.
All right. He still isn't done with his explanation, so we'll read a little bit more. We'll read verses 9 through 12. Who'll take that, please?
And here is the mind which hath wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits. And there are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not. Yet come. One is, and the other is not yet come, and when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, and is of the seven, and goeth into perdition. And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings, which have received no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast.
Now, this is the explanation. Now, maybe that doesn't sound like much of an explanation. Maybe that sounds like the explanation needs explanation. But actually, this is a very critical proposition that he outlines here. And he expects the one who reads this to properly evaluate just what he said. We've got to, you'll find this true in Revelation. Revelation is a very specific book.
you start generalizing, you may get a general idea, but you can see from the account here that he's very, very specific. First place, he mentions how many heads?
Seven.
All right, what else does he mention? There are seven heads. There are ten horns, yes. But what else? He says there are seven heads and what?
Seven mountains.
Yeah. And there are seven kings. Now, seven and seven makes 14. There's a... In other words, the Revelator is making a little distinction between the heads and the kings. Now, very often we read that and we don't catch the detail. But he says there are seven heads and there are seven kings. And he doesn't say that the seven heads are fallen. One is and one is yet to come. He says there are seven kings. One is. Five are fallen. One is. And another is yet to come. And when he cometh, he must continue a short space. Now, it's talking about the kings and heads. He says that the seven heads, what are they?
Seven mountains.
They are seven mountains. And what's the mountain? The kingdom. It's a government. There are seven mountains upon which this woman sits. Now, this is the tie-in, really, of all our other beasts. They all have seven heads. And because these, that is, the two other beasts, I mean, there are three beasts that have seven heads, and this gives us the marking of the first head. He says that the woman sits on the seven heads. And where was the first time that the woman, the papacy, got a seat in government? At what time in history? Pardon?
539 AD?
Well, even before that.
Constantine's
time is the first time where the church was brought in into civil matters. We read in quotations from the second volume to show how that even before Constantine's time, the church, there were certain bishops that were very influential. We can't, of course, read that again. But at Constantine's time, we find that the woman was given recognition as a religion of the state. Constantine himself became a Christian, and he called the Christian bishops into session, and Christianity got a seat in government. In other words, here was in one respect the first time that the woman received any recognition, any position in the Roman Empire. Up to that time, she had been persecuted and Christianity was rejected by the Roman authorities. But at Constantine's time, the tide completely turned and Christianity was accepted. And so we would date the first head then at the time of Constantine. And in that there are seven kings who are... what would we think a king was in relationship to the head? Anyone a thought? In other words, we believe that the kings and the heads are very much related, but they represent an emperor who sets into motion a form of government. And that's what Constantine did. He was an emperor. He was apparently the first king. That gave recognition to this woman, gave her a seat in civil matters. He did this especially when he moved the capital to Constantinople. He left more or less the Bishop of Rome as the most influential person in the Roman hemisphere, and consequently we see that the woman there was beginning to have authority in government. So Constantine, we believe, was the first king. Now, the king is an emperor that sets into motion a government. Now, Constantine died. But that didn't mean the day he died that everything ended. For instance, we believe that Charlemagne was one of these kings. But he set into government a Holy Roman Empire that lasted for nearly 1,000 years, or it did last 1,000 years, the Holy Roman Empire. So, now here is a matter, of course, that may be debated. We have nothing written that tells us specifically what these seven kings are. I don't know of anything in Brother Russell's writing. And it's a matter of studying these matters to piece them together. But I believe we're on good ground in saying that Constantine was the first king who set the first head on all of these beasts. The dragon, we're introduced to the dragon as having seven heads, so apparently it's talking about the Roman Empire starting at about the time Constantine's form of government was holding sway in the earth. And when it speaks about the leopard-like beast, it having seven heads, we would understand that that's when the papacy, as it were, rose up out of the sea and began to exercise its influence. In other words, the setting of the 13th chapter starts at the time of Constantine, because it has seven heads. And we believe that these seven heads fit into the seven successive stages. They all fit into the same time period. I don't know if that's, I'm making that clear or not. The first head was the undivided empire of Constantine. Now, after Constantine's death, it continued shortly. It was divided between his two sons, but then later it became known as the Western Roman Empire. And we believe the king, who was the more or less the king over that particular head or kingdom or that succession of government in the Roman Empire, was Valentinian. And he, by the way, is the most difficult one to establish. If someone can find a better king for that particular phase of government, I'd like to know, because it's something that you hate to be arbitrary on, but in that the Revelator says there are seven kings, we have to more or less wade through history and try to pick out the outstanding one that would fit into this picture. We're quite certain that the first one was Constantine, because that's where the Roman Empire got its start. The second one, we believe, was the Western Roman Empire under Valentinian. The third one was the Byzantine or Eastern Empire of Justinian. Now, that one is a little more clearly established in history. That's at 539 A.D. Remember when Justinian brought in his armies and overthrew the Ostrogoths and established the Bishop of Rome as head over all the holy churches. And that's the date that we mark papacy's full establishment as a papal system. And then we have the next head, the fourth head, which would be the Holy Roman Empire, and the king for that head, we believe, would be Charlemagne. I don't think there'd be much controversy about him, nor would there be about Justinian or about Constantine. I think that most Bible students would agree pretty much that these heads and these kings would fulfill the picture. The sixth head, or the sixth succession of government in the Roman Empire, was the Napoleonic. The fifth was the Napoleonic. Excuse me, I'm skipping ahead here. It was the Napoleonic era, and of course Napoleon would be its head. And I don't think that he would be a difficult person to establish in history, especially in that he's established even, as we understand it, in Daniel's prophecy as the one that was literally referred to as Napoleon. Then the sixth one would be the Victor Emmanuel government. And Victor Emmanuel, of course, would be the king. Now here is a point where we have a variation with what Brother Russell has written. going to be honest with this matter, but we'll explain why we feel that this variation is justified, why it, as it were, must be. The seventh head would be the fascist Nazi regime, and the seventh king, we believe, would, I'm not sure whether it would be Mussolini or Hitler. Take your pick, but Hitler was the most outstanding, but Mussolini was perhaps the nearest associated with the papacy. Now, how many heads are there in this chapter? Let's be sure that we got them all counted up. He says, how many?
Seven.
Are you sure there's only seven and not eight? That's what we want to be sure of. He says seven. That's what the Revelator says. So it's seven it is. There are not eight heads. There are seven. Eight must be something that is not a head, in other words. Because he clearly says there are seven heads and there are seven kings, but he doesn't say anything about an eighth head or an eighth king. Right? I mean, that point established, we believe, in the scriptures here.
Well, it says, even he is the eighth and is of the seven.
Yes, we'll get into that. He is the eighth and is of the seven. Well, now we've identified, as best we could, the seven heads and the seven kings. And now we want to take a critical examination of what is written here. He says, the beast that thou saw. In other words, this beast here that has the woman writing on it, it's a peculiar exclamation. He says, this beast that you're looking at, it was, but it is not, and it is yet to be. Now that's a funny beast for a woman to be riding a beast that was and is not and is yet to be. If you couldn't actually have it literally, a woman couldn't ride a beast that was and is not. That's mixing the explanation with the picture. That's how you get that paradox. But he says that this beast was. At one time, this beast existed. And then it ceased to exist. And then it comes into being once again. Now, who is this beast? That's the burning question. And for an answer, I'd like to turn to the second volume. This is the only place that I know of in Brother Russell's writings where he specifically stated what this beast was, and then he didn't make any elaboration on it, he just mentions what it was. On page 356 and 357, we just quote briefly from this paragraph. Although papacy was organized as a religious system long before and was even set up in temporal power in A.D. 539, yet it was Charlemagne who first actually bestowed and formally recognized the temporal dominion of the Pope. As Charlemagne was the first emperor over the Holy Roman Empire, A.D. 800, so Francis II was the last. And he voluntarily surrendered his title in 1806. Then he goes on to say, and this is the part that we're interested, as prior to the year 800, papacy was rising, supported by the Roman people and by its horn powers. So since 1800, it has been cast off from temporal authority over kings and peoples. And then he cites Revelation 17, 16, and 17. Now he says papacy was rising, supported by the Roman beast. And then he cites Revelation citation here. So we believe that this beast here would represent the Roman people's government. It's a poor government because it didn't have any head, or didn't have any crown. And It didn't have any of the glory that the other beasts had. This beast really was not, for the most part of its existence. During the seven heads, we believe, during these seven stages of the Roman Empire, covered from Constantine's time to practically our day, this beast really was not. Now, we understand the explanation to be this. Originally, Rome, when it started out, remember with the Republic, it had a Senate. And the Senate was ruled by two classes. There were the plebeians and the patricians. The patricians were the aristocracy. They were the wealthy ones. And when Rome started out as a republic, the patricians, the aristocracy, more or less, were the influential part of the Senate. They ruled the Roman Empire. The plebeians, who represented the common people, they were the representatives of the common people in the Senate, they were the weaker part. They were something like the House of Commons and House of Lords. The House of Lords at one time was the House of England. But in time, the tables turned and the House of Commons became the common power in England. And so a similar situation existed in the Roman Empire. The plebeians gradually being a majority, and the patricians being, even though they were wealthy, being a minority, gradually the plebeians' voice in government, the common people, began to have a say the way the government was to be run. And they began to bring in legislation that was to their favor. And the common people were having a fairly successful period of authority in government. But as corruption began to set in the Senate, and even the senators whom the plebeians had sent there to represent them, as it were, began to be corrupt, and the common people couldn't get what they wanted through the Senate, what did they do? Well, they would appeal to military men to rise up on the scene, and they would get what they want. The generals, the great generals in Rome, they made their appeals to the common people. And if the people couldn't get what they wanted from the Senate, they would get behind some general, and the people would have their voice in government. But that was the days when the beast walked. That's when the Roman people had a government that represented them. But as Rome continued, the Republic crumbled, and the Empire arose. Now, this is all true to history. And under the Empire, you began to have these great dictators, which neither the rich nor the poor could exactly rule, although the rich were more represented in the government than the poor. The common people under these great dictators gradually lost their power. So by the time you get to Constantine, who was one of these great kings or emperors that ruled over the whole Roman domain, you find that the beast was not. It was in the abyss. It was in a dormant condition in which the people really had very little representation in government. That's our understanding of this particular matter. And he says, this beast was, and it is not, and it is yet to be. And they that dwell on the earth shall wonder, whose names are not written in the book of life and the foundation of the world, when they behold this beast that was and is not and yet is. It's going to be a great source of wonderment when they see a people's form of government representing the poor people, the common people, an uprising of this class of people having their voice in government. When that takes place, then you'll see the beast, as it were, coming up out of the abyss and asserting its authority in the earth. Then he goes on to say the seven heads are seven kingdoms upon which the woman sits. Now there you have the starting point with Constantine, and the finishing point is up at our day. Now, he says there are seven kings. Now, we're not talking about the head so much, although that's involved. When a king fell, why, it implied that his form of government fell also. Now, you also, it's maybe it's confusing, but you have to understand that there's a little difference between the emperor over the Roman Empire and the subservient king. See, actually, the great emperors of the Roman Empire were emperors that ruled over other kings even. They were, as it were, the lord of the whole Roman Empire. That is the distinction between the king, the seven kings, and the ten horns, which are ten kings. So you see, there are actually 17 kings mentioned in this book. Now, I'm stating it in a confused way, but the emperor, we must think of as the one who was over the Roman Empire. The ten kings, we must think of as being over a territorial division in the Roman Empire. That is, they have their little sectioned off country in Germany or Italy, whatever it is, and they're head over just that little portion of land. See, there's a difference between the seven great kings and these ten little 2x4 kings. Now, just to keep the record straight, he says that five of these kings are fallen. Five of these great kings, of these great emperors in the Roman Empire are fallen. Constantine, Valentinian, Justinian, Charlemagne, Napoleon. All of these kings are gone at the time that this vision is portrayed. Now, when did John see the vision of Revelation? What day was it? He was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. And what day is that in Antichrist? The millennial day. So, now here's the vantage point. John the Revelator is standing on the Lord's day. And when did the Lord's day begin? 1874. All right, he says, standing here, five kings are fallen. That would include up to Napoleon. One is, what one was in power when the Lord's Day began, 1878 and so on? Victor Emmanuel. And then he says, another king is yet to come, and when he cometh, he's going to continue a long period of time. Is that what he says? A short day. Now, we believe the sixth king was Victor Emmanuel, and the next one to follow him, the seventh, we believe was the Hitler or Nazi fascist regime with, I don't know which one to describe, Hitler or Mussolini, which would be the proper one, but the fact is that that regime only lasted 23 years as compared with all these other kingdoms that lasted, some of them, well, one of them lasted 1,000 years. This continued only a very short space. It started in 1922, under the Lateran Treaty that Mussolini entered into, and it ended in 1945. That's a very short space. All right. You see, this is all given just to tell us the judgment of a woman so that we can tell when this is to take place. It's a critical time. Well, that's the purpose of this. He's not going into all this detail so that we can have wrinkled brows, but the idea is so that as the Lord's people can intelligently pinpoint the date when Babylon, the great, is thrown down. Now, if our understanding is correct, and what I've said, we'll put it this way, we'll put it as a theory. Maybe a fact will develop that we'll have to modify this theory. We do not know, but as near as we can see at this time, the theory that we have presented seems to hold good, seems to fit the picture. But remember, there is nothing on this specific in what Brother Russell has written. He felt that this chapter was the key of Revelation. And actually it is. This gives us the timing of the seven heads. If we can establish the timing of the first head on this scarlet-colored beast, isn't it reasonable to conclude that all these two other beasts would fit into the same period of time? And these three beasts all have seven heads, see? So it's timing there. And it also gives us the exact pinpointing as to when this prophecy takes place. He's standing in the Spirit on the Lord's day. He says five kings are fallen. One is, another is yet to come. And when he comes, he continues a short space. And then he goes on to say this. And the beast that was. What beast that was? Remember that beast with seven heads, ten horns, at one time that had authority in the earth, the Roman people's government, which went into the abyss during the period of these seven heads, is one day to emerge. And this beast, the eighth, it is of the seven, one of the seven, is the thought that we understand from the Greek. And that takes us back to the 11th chapter of Revelation. Now, in the 11th chapter of Revelation, we learn of a wild beast. And we believe that that wild beast is really similar as this beast that we're considering in the 17th chapter of Revelation. Let's see now, where do we want to? Where does it speak about the wild beast here? The seventh verse. Will somebody read that, please? Revelation 11:7.
And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottom of the pit shall make war against them, and shall overcome them and kill them.
Yes. Now here, it says the beast, but actually in the Greek, it's a wild beast. Comes out of the abyss for a short season. And we understand this to be at the time of the French Revolution. Now, on this, Brother Russell was specific, and he also stated that what happened in this French Revolution was a portrayal of what the end would be like. But this was only a sample. When the 10th part of the Roman Empire fell, the French part fell, the 10th part of the city fell, he said this was a portrayal of what the end would be like. Now, this wild beast that just popped out of the abyss momentarily and made all this trouble, we believe, was the people's form of government. On this matter, I don't know if I can go in that detail, but what happened there in the French Revolution, the Third Estate, I believe, was formed, which was a representative body of the poor people. It started off as the French Commune, almost communist, you might say. And they developed what they call the Third Estate, and that became a ruling body. And from the Third Estate, finally, under the rising up of the common people, storming the Bastille, overthrowing the powers, both religious and temporal, that existed in the land, a revolution took place in France. It threw down all the dignitaries, as it were, in the land, and threw down religion and everything else. Anarchy reigned. It was a dreadful time in France. It was a picture, a shadow of things to come, Brother Russell said. And, of course, this beast disappeared. Later, Napoleon, who took the Pope captive in 1799, he made a contrabat with the church. And Napoleon and this is the part that many people don't know, changed his attitude toward the church. The papacy, which the whose pope he put into prison, he made a concert that with, and the papacy, while it was subservient to him, was nonetheless recognized as the state religion of France. But we believe that when it says that the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth and is of the seven, it refers back to one of the seven. One of the seven, which was during the fifth head, the Napoleonic head, this wild beast that came up, the common people that formed the commune and the third estate and that caused all that trouble in Europe. That there's a shadow of a destruction that is to take place at this end of the age, which Brother Uphold, on that part, was very clear. But he doesn't tie it in with Revelation, the 17th chapter, but in that it's one of the seven. And Brother Uphold specifically states that the eighth form of the beast is not a head, to which also Revelation 17 agrees, because there are only seven heads. That this eighth form of the beast would be a headless one. In other words, there would not be one emperor over this wild beast. Like, in other words, in Charlemagne's day, he was the emperor over the whole Roman government. But there will not be another king. After the fall of the Hitler-Nazi regime, there will not be one ruler that's going to dominate Europe as an emperor anymore. The power from that day, from the fall of this seventh head, is going to be divided between 10 kings. There is not going to be one king that will rule over the Roman Empire. Now, are there any questions up to this point? I perhaps should have stopped sooner along the way for questions. Even if there's any part that isn't clear, I know it's an awful lot of detail to absorb in a short period of time. And Revelation is a book of detail. With all the things that it's just going to be a simple matter to just more or less pick it up. I don't think that that will be true at all, because there's too much detail, and you have to be very careful with the detail in order to meet really with the mind of the Lord and what he's trying to say.
This
piece
is headless. This includes
the headless
because it only mentions the seven heads.
Seven heads. There are not eight heads, and on top of this, Brother Russell says that there would not be another head. It would be the beast itself. And what is the beast? The beast is the Roman people's form of government. A government that represents John Q. Nobody. No, it's the common man on the street. And what do we see taking place in Europe today? We see the common people that are rising up on the scene. They're a group of people that have to be reckoned with. They have to be dealt with. They have to be satisfied. The common people have it in their power to change things now in Europe. And we expect, as this prophecy indicates, that there will be 10 kings that will emerge out of it. There's 10 kings that have received no kingdom as yet. Does that answer your question now?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Would we consider Russia as being one of the 10 kings? And what relationships might have communism today?
Well, no, I don't think Russia, it would not be a country. A king would represent a ruler. The territorial part that he ruled would be also involved in it, that's true. But the king, to be consistent with the picture, just as the head was represented Roman Empire, and the seven kings represented the seven monarchs or emperors, so these ten kings would represent individuals. Individuals who have given God-given grant to rule with the beast, with this people form of government. Now, communism, it's hard to say. We hate to use words because there's where we have to watch the events as they develop. Sometimes these things that develop are called by different names. Some call it socialism. Some call it communism. They have a thin form of communism that's spreading, like in Poland and Yugoslavia. It's not altogether Russian, and it's not pro-West, and it's not pro-East. It's communist that recognizes the individualism of each nation. They want to be ruled by themselves. They want to have their own king, but they want to have a form of socialism or communism in their particular area. They don't want Moscow to rule them. They don't mind communism or socialism if it's their own kind, the kind that they can have a voice in. But they don't want somebody either from the United States or from Russia to tell them how they want to run the country. And that's natural. Nobody likes to be dominated from an outside country. It goes against the human grain.
Did each of these seven kings have a whole?
Yes. The seven kings we want to think of as emperors. Emperors like Charlemagne, who was head over all the empire. And Justinian and so on, all of these great men who, there may have been subservient kings to them, but they were recognized as the head of that particular form of government, and they set in motion a form of government that endured for a period of time. I mean, Charlemagne died in a few years, but the Holy Roman Empire, which he found was so successful. Before we go into any more explanation, if anyone has any particular questions on this chapter, I would be glad to entertain them before we get into any deeper.
What
does
the scarlet color of the beast represent?
All right, what's the scarlet represent? We have a good basis for this. So this apparently would be a sinful beast also. And that too, you'll notice, is shown here is an unclean animal with a hairy through the more or less the snout of a warthog or something it could call. Wild boar, I guess it is. But it is a sinful, unclean animal. In this respect, it's something like the great red dragon, which is also a sinful animal. In this respect, it has two similarities to the dragon. It is red, and it also has seven heads. But that's where the similarities end. So, George, did you have any thoughts?
No, I was just wondering.
Any other questions?
I was also wondering what the difference is between red and scarlet.
Well, who knows the difference between red and scarlet? Yes, I think that's the answer, Sister Knight. Scarlet is a deeper hue, although red. Scarlet is red. But it's just a specific type of red. In other words, red could be any variation. It could be light, dark, or indifferent. But scarlet gives you more or less the particular type of red that it is, the real deep red. Right.
Brother
Kenneth?
I can ask Brother Harry to think as an artist, because they consider scarlet to be red. The point I have in mind, any brother made quite a point to this being scarlet being red, and that it's communism. Actually, it's not red. I think it might be a distinct kind of beast.
Well, I don't know if I don't remember offhand what the Greek is. Harry, did you get your question?
He's up there in the bedroom.
Oh, well, we can't very well bother him now. But that's something we can check into. It doesn't use the same word as it does for the dragon. I mean, that's, it helps us to not confuse the two animals.
Mm-hmm.
No, Charles.
In the dialogue, it uses the word scarlet. In the interlinear.
Oh, yeah. Well, I remember looking up the word scarlet, and it's, I recall it's the bright red. Whether it's in the Greek, I'm not sure offhand whether that would be supported, but I'm sure that the dialogue is given a pretty fair discussion of it.
What does the dialogue say about the 12 trees in Revelation? The red dragon, the coriander, the scarlet.
In that verse it says fiery red. Mm-hmm. And dragon great fiery red.
Which would be a lighter fire than an orangey color, more or less, wouldn't it? I mean, you think of a fiery red as being a little lighter hue.
Yes. A garnet and blue.
Well, that would be more like my definition of the fiery then, and have an orange flavor. The fiery red would be a real red. Well, anyway, it's a simple beat. I think we can agree on that. It's very readily. Any other questions?
Since all the clothes on the woman,
well, I think so. All of the details are given to portray her as a very wealthy woman, and it pictures her in another part of Revelation as sitting a queen, and there's your purple color, which is a regal color, and she was decked with gold, precious stones, and having a golden cup in her hand. All these things we believe are symbolic, emblematic of the scriptures and the precious things in the scriptures, the divine things that she had access to, even though the cup which she held, she had the outside of it golden, all right, but inside was a lot of bad things. But I think the clothing generally would describe her as a queen, as a regal woman. Any other questions thus far? Well, if not, we'll go on. It's this matter, I think, as we get into it a little more, will become a little plainer. It's just that we have so many details to absorb that it seems confusing, but I'm sure if you went over this a few times, it becomes easier each time. All right, now we'll start in with the 12th verse, even though we did read that, and read on a little bit. 12, well, to the end of the chapter. Let's read it all. Who has a good, loud voice? So, Kenneth, do you want to read that, please?
From the 12th on?
Yeah, 12 to the end.
And the ten horns which thou sawest are ten kings, which receives no kingdom as yet, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. These have one mind, and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings. And they that are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. And he saith unto me, the waters which thou sawest, where the whore sitteth, are peoples, the multitudes, the nations, and tongues. And the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, he shall hate the whore, and make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire. For God has put in their hearts to fulfill his will, and to agree, and give their kingdom unto the beast, until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigneth over the kings of the earth.
Now, you see, what the Revelator has done up to this point, he's taken us through history. He started back in Constantine time and showed us the seven great emperors who ruled in seven successive stages, and he showed us the seven empires that these kings or emperors made. And he finally comes to the end of that. He comes to the end of the seventh head, or the seventh king and the seventh head, which means that those emperors and those empires are all gone now. So we'll just rest them for a minute. We have, let's forget about the seven kings and the seven heads now, because that's all past history. We're interested in now in ten kings, and we're interested in this wild beast, this scarlet-colored beast that comes up out of the abyss, that is the eighth. In other words, it's the form of government that comes after the seven heads and seven kings are off the scene, which is the now in prophecy. And that's the part, really, that all of this history was given for. As detailed as it is, it was given so that we can charter our course as to where we are on the scene of time. If we are correct in our understanding, it means that the seven heads and seven kings are past history. We're living in a time in which the scarlet-colored beast, this beast, that was not the people's form of government, in which the common people were a force and power in the earth, and when that form of government should be rising up on the European picture. And I think that is what is happening in Europe today. Now, going on with this story, after he tells us about these seven great kings, then he starts talking about small things. He starts talking about small kings, ten kings. Now, these ten kings are somewhat different from the other kings, the other horns that we have seen. He says that the ten horns that you saw on this beast, that is, these ten horns that you saw on this beast, what about these ten horns? Yeah, the ten kings. Well, that's good. We know what they are now. We know that these ten horns here are really ten kings. But what about these four kings? They have no kingdom. But the story isn't that sad for them, because they receive grant of a kingdom. Isn't that what the account says? It says that they receive, how does that read?
Power, that's 1 hour.
1 hour with the beast. They receive power. Now, this is in the accusative case in the Greek. And it doesn't mean that they have power for the whole hour. It's not talking about the point of time. It's talking about the duration of time. It's talking about in this time. They receive a grant of a kingdom. Now, the words as yet, they have received no kingdom as yet. The as yet, yet, you'll notice, I think, in your King James Version, is italics, right? No?
No, it's not in the time yet.
Well, I think in the Dyslop, then, it's supposed to be omitted. somewhere it's omitted, and some brethren say that, well, that shouldn't be there. The as yet part.
It is. There are brackets around the yet here in the guidelines.
So we won't quarrel about whether the words as yet should be there, because we know from the subsequent account that that's true, that they have received no kingdom as yet. That's really what it means. Because they later receive a kingdom. And when they receive their kingdom, they give their power and their strength unto who? Unto the beast. So, in other words, if they have received no kingdom, how could they give their kingdom to the beast? They must finally receive a kingdom. Now, that's the thought. These 10 kings, or 10 horns, as they're portrayed in the picture, we must think of them as 10 kings that are going to arise. And we believe in the European picture, these 10 kings, they have God-given grant to receive power with a people's form of government. That's what the account says. They receive power as kings, or during that hour, they receive power with the beast. God doesn't give them any other privilege. He gives them this privilege for a particular purpose. See, he started out to tell us about the judgment of this woman. That's what we're really interested in. And he's using these 10 kings and this unclean beast, which the woman has been riding, even though the beast has been in a dormant condition. The people have been supporting the papacy, but they have had no voice in government down throughout the Roman period of history. He's using these 10 kings and the beast to destroy the woman. That's really the whole point and substance of the lesson of the 17th chapter of Revelation. And all this is merely a pinpointing of time so that you and I can read the details and approximate the period of time we're in and when the exact judgment of this woman is to be consummated. Now, you notice it says that this woman, by the way, where does she sit? She sits in two places in this 17th chapter of Revelation.
What is it?
She sits, yes, it says the waters which thou sawest are the peoples and nations and tongue where the whore sitteth. So she sits on the waters, the people of Europe. All right. She sits there. What else? Where else does she sit? Yes, she sits on the scarlet-colored beast, but where does she sit on the beast? Yes, she says the 7 heads are 7 kingdoms upon which the woman sits. So she sat on the head of the beast. That's sitting on the beast. Maybe the horns wouldn't be so comfortable. But she had a nice soft throne, a watery throne, and she sat on all 7 of those heads. During this, in other words, this woman shrewdly kept her authority, her queenly authority, all during the Roman Empire. And while this poor form of people's government was voiceless and dormant during the Empire of Rome, the woman was sitting on these people and their form of government, which really didn't exist, it was dormant. It only existed in from the standpoint of a principle within the hearts of the people that they should one day rise up and have their way. Now, this is all centered around a war. And there are 2 wars mentioned in Revelation. One in the 19th chapter of Revelation, which we'll get into. And one in the 17th chapter of Revelation. But we don't believe they're 2 separate wars. They're the same war. They both instances mention the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. In this instance, we're told that when this war takes place, when these 10 horns and the beast, or when these 10 horns, does it say and the beast? Let's see. Just as these 10 horns, or these ten kings shall make war with the land. These ten kings are going to make war with the land, and the land shall overcome them, for he is King of kings and Lord of lords, and what else?
And they that are with him.
And what else?
Called, chosen, and faithful.
Called, chosen, and faithful. That, again, is a beautiful point for us to absorb. At the time that this war takes place, they that are with him, called, chosen, and additionally considered faithful. Many are called, few are chosen, and fewer still are faithful. But when this war takes place, they are all the church called, chosen, and their crowns are all important and faithful. That's when this war takes place. Now, to try to put it into the past as a generality, in a sense, it's all right. I think generally we sometimes can apply scriptures generally. In a sense, there has been opposition to the incoming kingdom and so on. And from that standpoint, we may think of the kings as making war on the land. But see, these kings, these ten kings, as we see it, haven't really received their kingdoms yet. They haven't really, in Europe, completely subscribed to a people's form of government. Whether it be socialism or communism or whatever the name happens to be when it emerges, we don't want to quibble over words. It's got to be, in the final analysis, it's got to be a government that the people, the common people, the poor people, have a voice. Because that's what the grant is for. They weren't given power for any other purpose. These ten kings were given power with the beast. This beast here, the scarlet-colored beast, which is not the papacy. I mean, this scarlet-colored beast has been repeatedly, by Bible students, been confused with the leopard-like beast. But it's not the leopard-like beast. It's a different beast. Because we'll prove that as we get on here in our study. You know, it would be queer anyway for the papacy. If this scarlet-colored beast is the papacy, why would it want to make war with a woman and eat it? Papacy represents Catholicism as a government here on earth. And additionally, we read in the 16th chapter of Revelation. We want to read that again. Somebody read it, please. Sixteenth verse.
And the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast, these shall hate the whore, and shall make her desolate and naked, and shall eat her flesh, and burn her with fire.
Now, in your Bibles, if you have a pencil, it says, the ten horns which thou sawest upon the beast. Change that word upon to an. Now, we have good authority for that because the Grisbach's Recension, the Sinaitic Manuscript, the Diaglot, the English Revised, the American Standard Revised, the Revised Standard Version, Rotherham, Moffat, Weymouth, Vatican Manuscript, 1160, Alexandrian Manuscript, Codex Vaticanus, and Codex Ephraimic Rescriptus. All of that supports this thought of the ten horns and the beast eating the woman. And that's really what this whole chapter is about. It's the judgment of this woman, the time when the King of Kings and Lord of Lords is going to destroy this abominable woman from off the face of the earth.
Isn't that the same thing? The ten horns and the beast, aren't they one and the same? Aren't they the people's form of government?
Well, the ten horns are the king, and the beast represents the people's form of government. In other words, you think of the king as individual, and the beast as a form of government. Just like in the other picture where we had seven heads and seven kings. The seven kings represent individuals. The heads represented government over which these individuals ruled. Any further questions? Now, this is a critical time in history. And understanding this, if the theory is correct, and that's how we'll know how a theory is correct. That's the way you can tell a true prophet from a false one. It's the thing that he says comes to pass, and you know it's true. Well, we're not pretending to be prophets, but it is a theory. Now, a theory is not necessarily wrong. It can be a true theory. And what we have presented tonight is such a theory. We have been watching the developments in Europe. If our understanding is correct, we will never again see one man rule Europe. That's what this means. There were only seven kings. There were only seven emperors. That day is no more past. After these seven emperors pass off the scene, the universal wars of the Roman Empire are gone. Then, when the beast comes up out of the abyss, it's going to emerge with ten kings. Ten kings, ten men, are going to arise on the scene, and they're going to say, well, our power is with the people. Let's appeal to the poor people, to the common people, to the masses. Let's give them a voice in government. And those kings that do that, the Lord assures them success up to a point, because they have the power to do that. They have power 1 hour, or during this hour, during this God-given grant of time, to receive a kingdom with the beast, with no other form of government. And it's got to be the ten kings. That's what the scriptures say. It's not going to be one king. It's got to be with the ten. Now, what we want to do, too, is to parallel these wars. We can trace where we are by proper parallelization. Let's just turn to the 19th chapter. We, of course, can't... this will come to a later study. We haven't really finished our discussion of the leopard-like beast. We only, more or less, discussed the introduction to it. And later we'll get into the final end and destruction of it. But we believe these two wars, the one mentioned in the 17th chapter and then the 19th chapter, are the same war against the same king, the kings and lord of lords, only they're shown from different standpoints. You notice we said the 17th chapter was a complete story. It tells you everything it started out to tell you right in the one chapter. Whereas chapter 13 that introduced the leopard-like beast to us doesn't finish the destruction of the beast, of the leopard-like beast, until Revelation, the 19th chapter. It goes on through chapter and chapter and chapter until finally it comes to the point where you see the dragon destroyed and the leopard-like beast destroyed. And the 19th chapter is finally where the hosts of sin are all destroyed, and that takes in the papacy, that takes in the false prophets, and that takes in the kings of the earth and their armies, which are really representative of the dragon. But in this 11th chapter, you notice the setting, starting in the 11th verse. It's the King of Kings who is coming to make war. He doesn't come like at his first advent without a crown, riding upon an ass, meek and lowly. Behold, your king cometh unto you, meek and lowly, riding on an ass. In this chapter, 11th verse, who'll read it? 11th and 12th verses. Bob, do you have it there, please?
And I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse. And he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war. His eyes were as a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. And he had a name written that no man knew but he himself.
Yes, now you see here, the King of Kings, Lord of Lords, is an aggressor. He comes on a white horse, which represents doctrine, pure doctrine, but also a white horse was usually the animal of war, and it was often the animal of prince or king. And this time he has on his head many crowns. He didn't come like at the first advent without any crown still on. The only crown he had was the crown of thorns. And he has a name written that no man knoweth. but be himself, and so on. Well, we are familiar with that part, and it's all tied in with the treading of the winepress here in the 15th verse. Well, maybe we better read it just to correlate the wars. Well, somebody read on to the 16th verse. Alfie, do you have it there, please? Yes, please.
And he was clothed with a vesture dipped in blood, and his name is called the Word of God. And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. And out of his mouth goes his sharp sword, that with it he should smite the nations, and he shall rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the winepress of the fierceness and wrath of Almighty God. And he had on his vesture and on his thigh a name written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords.
Yes. And of course, then he, if you remember the rest of this count, the great conqueror, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, his confident victory, he comes in righteousness to make war. That's his very purpose, to make war with this beast. And we'll show you a picture of this war here.
This is a scene portrayed in the 19th chapter. There's the right side there. It's the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, although he isn't shown. But opposing him on the opposite side, the leopard like beast, kings of the earth and their armies, there's the representation of the dragon, and with him the false prophet, in fact, the Church of England and Ireland, and also the Federation of Churches. There's the end of your false church system. Now, you see the parallel between this war and that in the 17th chapter of Revelation. They're taken from different standpoints. The 17th chapter shows the details of how the Lord maneuvers world events so that he can destroy the woman. In the 17th chapter of Revelation, we're told how the Lord puts it into their hearts, the hearts of these 10 kings and the beasts, to hate the woman, to destroy her as a church system. Here we see the papacy and governments of earth being destroyed as governments in the earth. The 17th chapter shows the destruction of a false church. This shows the destruction of false government exercising power in the earth. It's the same picture, but from different standpoints, after all. There are not two such wars, and, but they're the same war and the same thing. Well, now, are there any questions up to this point? Who asked the question?
I was wondering whether in this 1990, whether these kings of the earth are the same as the kings of 10 kings in the 10 kings. I saw the beasts and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together.
Yes. I think they are the same kings. They're the only kings that exist at that time. I mean, in the Roman Empire, and that's particularly what this vision is concerned with. I mean, other nations will be involved in this matter by extension, but the picture of Revelation is concerned basically with what takes place in the Roman Empire.
And he hath on his vesture and on his thigh. What would be the... That's a funny place for a name, isn't it?
Yeah, well, of course, I don't know just what the significance there, except that it's written doubly on his thigh. Just the thigh would be where... Oh, no, his sword isn't on his thigh. It comes out of his mouth. The sword of his mouth, so I don't know what the thigh was signifying.
Was there some connection with Jacob, with the thigh? Did he put his hand on his thigh?
Yes, he shriveled it up. angel did when he was laying there at this. I don't know if anyone had a thought, so I was just mad to consider it. Of course, basically, I know we could go over each little point in considerable detail. That would take ever so long, but really the basis of this study is to get an overall concept, even though we welcome all the detail we can absorb, but that's why we haven't gone into every particular detail, every verse and every word to analyze it, because if we do that, I'm afraid that we won't be able to see the overall concept, which at this particular time we're really trying to get.
In the 14th verse of the 19th chapter, it mentions this, and the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean. Would that correspond with the verse in 14 that states, "Sit there, and they that are with him are called and chosen faithful"?
Yes, it is my thought, and others too, I know, feel the same way. That this war takes place when the saints are called, chosen, and faithful. And in this case, we see the armies which are in heaven, which is not the Lord's great army, but it's a holy army that is clothed in white. And Revelation tells us specifically that this white linen that it's talking about in Revelation is the righteousness of the saints, which is not so much the robe of Christ's righteousness in this particular sense, but it represents the fact that God has judged them righteous as new creatures in Christ Jesus.
Mm-hmm. These called children faithful, they correspond to those that are sealed in the forest?
Yes, I think so. I think that there's where all of this begins to tie in. You see, if we parallel these wars, then we see that naturally... The church would have to be complete. The sealing work would have to be done. And that would fulfill the seventh chapter of Revelation, where the four winds of heaven were held back until the saints were sealed in their forehead. And actually, it's the pouring out of the seventh vial, which was upon the air, which was the power of the air. The spiritual ruling powers of the air. It's the seventh plague. Poured out, we believe that finishes Babylon, and it finishes all these opposing forces of the Lord. That's where the great power of spiritual control is let loose and destroyed by the conquering Lord and King. In other words, I think it all ties in. There's other tie-ins which we'll get into. We're going to have to go back and pick up threads of thought from the 13th chapter on, but we purposely wanted to get over these five beasts basically, and then we'll follow the other beasts in detail up until the time that they are destroyed.
Brother Gene?
Brother, may
I just suggest a couple of scriptures?
Sure.
I was thinking about in connection with this 19th chapter. It's Micah 4:13 and Micah 5:1.
If you have them, read them please, sir.
Arise and fret, O daughter of Zion, for I will make thine horn iron, and I will make thy hoof brass, and thou shalt beat in pieces many people, and I will consecrate their gain unto the Lord, and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth. Now gather thyself in troops, O daughter of troops. He hath laid siege against us. They shall smite the judge of Israel with a rod upon the cheek. The thought seemed to me that those verses would fit in with this war in the 19th chapter of Revelation. Although the last statement in the first verse of chapter 5 might very well refer to the crucifixion of Jesus. Certain bruised his heel. Referring back to that at the time of he's bruising the serpent's head.
Thank you. Yes, that's a good thought. I just, while I think of it, I have a, just a few words here from Brother Russell in the fourth volume, page 17, where Brother Russell, he often repeats this, and sometimes easy to forget, but Brother Russell always identifies the treading of the winepress as the very last thing in the harvest. That's the last feature of the harvest. He says, on page 17, the treading of the winepress is the last feature of the harvest work. The reaping and gathering is all done first. So the treading of the winepress of the wrath of God into which the vine of the earth, the false vine, which has misappropriated the name Christian and Christ's kingdom, is cast when it is iniquitous, when its iniquitous clusters are fully ripe, represents the last work of this eventful harvest period. Now notice it's harvest period, and it's the Lord's harvest. And it's the angels, the Lord's angels, that are used in harvest. It pictures to our minds the last feature of the great time of trouble which shall involve all nations and of which we are so abundantly forewarned in the Scriptures. Now that was Brother Russell's thought. Now he says that first the true harvest is all reaped. Then the harvest of the vine of the earth takes place. So we've had the treading of the winepress by Bible students all down through this time, 7-5 particularly. They went out and gathered the clusters of the vine of the earth and cast them into the great winepress of the wrath of God and so on. But you see, it was predicated on the idea that the harvest was all over, and this was just a gathering of the vine of the earth, and it was all done. See, they were ready for the destruction feature. But actually, we know that back there and up till now, the saints haven't all been called, chosen, and faithful, and the gathering of the true harvest hasn't been completed. So this was Brother Russell's thought. So when in the 19th chapter, when he speaks about the treading of the winepress by the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, he's not talking about a general period all through this harvest, but he's talking about the time after the true harvest has been gathered, in which the Lord is finishing up the last part of the harvest, that is, gathering the clusters of this false vine of the earth and destroying it. There's another parallel of this war. That's the same thing from a different picture. Destruction of the wine, the grapes of the vine, the false vine, is the same thing as the war, showing different aspects. Any further questions on this matter?
Somewhere in the Old Testament, it speaks of the treader of grapes, which is where the farmer overtakes the reaper.
And the treader of grapes?
Does this
setting
of grapes there tie in with his
wife's question? I think so. I think this time of destruction will overtake the reapers. And he that soweth, what is it, seed? How is that? Well, the thought there I would get, simply tying this in with Revelation, is that this time of trouble finishes the harvest work and the sowing work. It's in this, in other words, the saints are be sowing up until the time that their end comes, and they'll be harvesting this vine of the earth, not the true harvest. But they'll be harvesting the vine of the earth as a part of their last work and commission when they're overtaken. The saints, this is corroborated in the 25th chapter of Matthew, the 13th chapter of Matthew, I've forgotten. I think it's the 13th for the parable of the wheat and tares. Yeah, the 13th. There the angels, they gather the wheat into the barn, and they also gather the tares in bundles, and they cast them into the fire to be burned. Who are the angels? Are there a different set of angels that do the gathering in one sense? And another set of angels that cast them into the fire?
Reapers are the angels.
Reapers are the angels. And we believe that the saints will have a work to do up until the last part. In other words, the saints are involved in this war. Up till this time, the saints have always been losing the battle against the Antichrist. Not from the standpoint that they lost out on the heavenly hope. We know that they were victorious in death, but they were never able to completely destroy the systems of sin, even though in the Reformation, one like Luther, some of the saints did a pretty good job of making war with that beast, this great Goliath that they put forth and said, who is able to make war with it? Well, some of the saints did a bad job, even though they lost out in the end, the beast still survived. But when the King of Kings begins to wield his sword, that's the end of all these beasts.
Dean, how do we reconcile the fact that the saints are with him, in that word, with Isaiah 63:3? I have trodden the wine press alone, and of the people there was none with me.
All right. As the treader of grapes, that would represent our Lord. He says that he does it alone. And the people, there was none with him. And Brother Russell says in the fourth volume, to no human generalship can the coming victory for truth and righteousness be ascribed. The Lord assumes full responsibility for this time of trouble. It's not the communists, it's not anybody else, but the Lord, as the King of Kings, assumes the complete responsibility for the destruction of these systems of sin. And the people, while he has a great army with them, they receive no credit for the work that they do. They are not considered as workmen of the Lord, even though he has a tremendous army that he uses to fulfill his will. But they get none of the credit because they are not with him. Do you have a thought on that, sir?
I think that fits very well. The saints clearly will be proved faithful, at least by the time this happens. So possible a few may not yet have been actually changed at the beginning of it. But they certainly have a share in breaking the nation to pieces like potter's vessel. That's clear in Revelation. So, but they are acting at one with Jesus. So as their general, he is the one that's doing it. Just as Gideon put the Midianites to flight, even though he had 300 working with him.
Yes, and the interesting thing about this war is we're not to think of it as being something apart from the Lord's word, because he smites the nation with a sword that proceeds out of his mouth. In other words, the papacy, they were using every means. They were using every possible means they could, deception and everything. But here the Lord, with the sword of his mouth, the truth, which is sharper than any two-edged sword, uses the truth to destroy the systems of sin. And he uses his saints, too, in the pouring out of these plagues, which we'll get into in the 16th chapter, which it all begins to tie in as we get into this thing a little more in detail. But I think we've pretty well covered the substance in this chapter, the 17th chapter. The story is complete. We started out by John taking us into the wilderness of separation and so on, and he shows us this judgment of the great whore. And we believe the angel here that shows John this is probably the angel of the second volume, chapter 9 on the man of sin. There is where Brother Russell shows us the judgment of the great whore. And in this same chapter, he tells us who the scarlet-colored beast is. He says it represents the Roman people. And we add the word government because the beast always represents the government. So in this same chapter, we believe the angel that showed us this would be the message that we have in the second volume on the man of sin. And then from there, we of course saw the history of the past so that we could pinpoint where we are on the stream of time. And having done that, we see what yet remains. There are 10 kings that are yet to emerge. There may be some on the scene already. We don't know. That are going to subscribe to a people's form of government. And when they do, when that all materializes, then we'll know exactly where our deliverance is, when it shall be. Because when we see the 10 kings subscribing to a people's form of government, we'll know that the strategic hour is near for the war to begin. They're going to make war on the land, and they'll lose. And the land, how are they going to lose the war? Well, the Lord puts it into their hearts. He changes their direction. They started out to destroy him and his followers, and he changes their direction, and he puts it into their hearts to hate the woman and to destroy her, to eat her, and so on. And they do. And the 10 horns and the beast together devour this woman. And that beast will say again so that no one will confuse it with the papacy. Papacy represents the Roman people's form of government, that is, of the common poor people.
Brother Gene?
Brother Charles?
May I ask this question? Do we feel that it will be the church who is on this side of the veil, who are the called and chosen and faithful, who will be associated with the Lord in this work here at the conclusion when Babylon would finally be destroyed?
Well, I think so. I think that all of Revelation, up to the 19th chapter particularly, is given to show to the saints the things which must speedily be done, and it involves the saints. That's why it's shown to them. I mean, if it was all to be done in heaven, why should the Lord go to such great details to manifest all of this to us now? Always with a revelation, there comes a responsibility associated with it. The whole message that we received in the harvest was in the mouth sweet, but in the stomach it was bitter. And that will be true, I think, of this revelation. Understanding it. As we come to understand it more, we'll find that it also will have a bitterness in the stomach. It's going to mean making our stand for the Lord and for the truth. And it's going to mean wielding the sword of the Spirit in a way perhaps which many feel is not Christian-like to do. That is, in a warfare against those who oppose the truth and who have opposed it down through the age. These great systems of sin, which the Lord said he was going to destroy with the spirit of his mouth.
Brother Jim, in regard to Brother Charles' question, I'm thinking here again about that 14th verse that I had mentioned earlier. And specifically, there says, "And the armies which were in heaven followed him upon white horses, clothed in fine linen, white and clean." Which in itself suggested that it was the righteousness of the saints themselves. And they would be with the Lord, they would be beyond the veil when that work is being done. And a little confused in that point.
Well, read on now in the 19th verse.
"And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him that sat on the horse and against his army."
What happened to the army? Well, you notice it started off, it says that there were armies in heaven. Now, this is not the heavens of heavens, the real heavens. This is the heavens of earth. The saints, as far as I'm concerned, they don't go to heaven when they die. They stay right here for 1,000 years. The heavens of earth. But we shall all be caught up with the Lord in the air. But be that as it may, I don't want to involve any more theology than necessary. The heavens here are the heavens of Revelation. They're the powers spiritual control on the things of the earth. It represents them at a time in which the Lord has assumed complete regal authority in the spiritual heavens, and he'll not tolerate any counterfeit power in his domain. He is the ruler. He is the King of Kings in the heavens. And like what the man-child did to the dragon, he cast him out. So that's what the King of Kings is doing. He's throwing out of office and out of power all opposing powers that he does not recognize. And that's what it means when they're with him in heaven. Now, that's true. Some of the things are in glory.